The question I get asked most often. This was a talk first given for Portland Arts and Lectures in October 2000, then for Seattle Arts and Lectures in April 2002. I have revised it slightly for publication. It has not been published before, though bits of it can be found in my book, Steering the Craft, and elsewhere in my writings about writing. As a talk, it was called, Where Do You Get Your Ideas From? But in my previous collection of talks and essays, The Language of the Night, there's a different essay with that title, there being many answers to the question. So I have retitled it. The question fiction writers get asked most often is, where do you get your ideas from? Harlan Ellison has been saying for years that he gets ideas for his stories from a mail-order house in Schenectady. When people ask, where do you get your ideas from? What some of them really want to know is the email address of that company in Schenectady. That is, they want to be writers because they know writers are rich and famous, and they know that there are secrets that writers know, and they know if they can just learn those secrets, that mystical address in Schenectady, they will be Stephen King. Writers, as I know them, are poor, they are infamous, and they couldn't keep a secret if they had one. Writers are wordy people. They talk, they blab, they yatter. They whine all the time to each other about what they're writing and how hard it is. They teach writing workshops and write writing books and give talks about writing like this. Writers tell all. If they could tell beginners where to get ideas from, they would. In fact, they do all the time. Some of them actually get somewhat rich and famous by doing it. What do the how-to-write writers say about getting ideas? They say stuff like, listen to conversations. Note down interesting things you hear or read about. Keep a journal. Describe a character. Imagine a dresser drawer and describe what's in it. Yeah, but that's all work. Anybody can do work. I want to be a writer. What's the address in Schenectady? Well, the secret to writing is writing. It's only a secret to people who don't want to hear it. Writing is how you be a writer. So why did I want to try to answer this foolish question, where do you get your ideas from? Because underneath the foolishness is a real question, which people really yearn to have answered. A big question. Art is craft. All art is always and essentially a work of craft. But in the true work of art, before the craft and after it, is some essential, durable core of being, which is what the craft works on and shows and sets free. The statue in the stone. How does the artist find that, see it, before it's visible? That is a real question. One of my favorite answers is this. Somebody asked Willie Nelson how he thought of his tunes, and he said, the air is full of tunes, I just reach up and pick one. Now that is not a secret, but it is a sweet mystery. And a true one, a true mystery. That's what it is. For a fiction writer, a storyteller, the world is full of stories, and when a story is there, it's there, and you just reach up and pick it. Then you have to be able to let it tell itself. First, you have to be able to wait in silence. Wait in silence and listen. Listen for the tune, the vision, the story. Not grabbing, not pushing, just waiting, listening, being ready for it when it comes. This is an act of trust. Trust in yourself, trust in the world. The artist says, the world will give me what I need and I will be able to use it rightly. Readiness, not grabbiness, not greed, readiness. Willingness to hear, to listen carefully, to see clearly, see accurately, to let the words be right. Not almost right, right. To know how to make something out of the vision, that's the craft, that's what practice is for. Because being ready doesn't mean just sitting around, even if it looks like that's what writers mostly do. Artists practice their art continually, and writing is an art that involves a lot of sitting. Scales and finger exercises, pencil sketches, endless unfinished and rejected stories. The artist who practices knows the difference between practice and performance, and the essential connection between them. The gift of those seemingly wasted hours and years is patience and readiness, a good ear, a keen eye, and a skilled hand, a rich vocabulary and grammar. The Lord knows where talent comes from, but craft comes from practice. With those tools, those instruments, with that hard-earned mastery, that craftiness, artists do their best to let the idea, the tune, the vision, the story, come through clear and undistorted, clear of ineptitude, awkwardness, amateurishness, undistorted by convention, fashion, opinion. This is a very radical job, this dealing with the ideas you get if you are an artist and take your job seriously, this shaping a vision into the medium of words. It's what I like best to do in the world, and craft is what I like to talk about when I talk about writing, and I could happily go on and on about it. But I'm trying to talk about where the vision, the stuff you work on, the idea, comes from. So, the air is full of tunes. A piece of rock is full of statues. The earth is full of visions. The world is full of stories. As an artist, you trust that. You trust that that is so. You know it is so. You know that whatever your experience, it will give you the material, the ideas, for your work. From here on, I'll leave out music and fine arts and stick to storytelling, which is the only thing I truly know anything about, though I do think all the arts are one at the root. All right, these ideas. What does that word mean? Idea is a shorthand way of saying the material, the subject, subjects, the matter of a story, what the story is about, what the story is. Idea is a strange word for an imagined matter, not abstract but intensely concrete, not intellectual but embodied. However, idea is the word we're stuck with, and it's not wholly off-center because the imagination is a rational faculty. I got the idea for that story from a dream I had. I haven't had a good story idea all year. Here am I, sitting after half the morning, crammed with ideas and visions and so on, and can't dislodge them for lack of the right rhythm. That last sentence was written in 1926 by Virginia Woolf in a letter to a writer friend, and I will come back in the end to it, because what she says about rhythm goes deeper than anything I have ever thought or read about where art comes from. But before I can talk about rhythm, I have to talk about experience and imagination. Where do writers get their ideas from? From experience. That's obvious. And from imagination. That's less obvious. Fiction results from imagination working on experience. We shape experience in our minds so that it makes sense. We force the world to be coherent, to tell us a story. Not only fiction writers do this, we all do it. We do it constantly, continually, in order to survive. People who can't make the world into a story go mad. Or, like infants, or perhaps animals, they live in a world that has no history, no time but now. The minds of animals are a great, sacred, present mystery. I do think animals have languages, but they are entirely truthful languages. It seems that we are the only animals who can lie. We can think and say what is not so and never was so, or what has never been, yet might be. We can invent, we can suppose, we can imagine. All that gets mixed in with memory, and so we're the only animals who tell stories. An ape can remember and extrapolate from her experience. Once I stuck a stick in that anthill and the ants crawled on it, so if I put this stick in that anthill again, maybe the ants will crawl on it again and I can lick them off again. Yum. But only we human beings can imagine, can tell the story about the ape who stuck a stick in an anthill and it came out covered with gold dust, and a prospector saw it, and that was the beginning of the great gold rush of 1877 in Rhodesia. That story is not true. It is fiction. Its only relation to reality is the fact that some apes do stick sticks in anthills, and there was a place once called Rhodesia. But there was no gold rush in 1877 in Rhodesia. I made it up. I am human, therefore I lie. All human beings are liars. That is true. You must believe me. Fiction. Imagination working on experience. A great deal of what we consider our experience, our memory, our hard-earned knowledge, our history, is in fact fiction. But never mind that. I'm talking about real fiction. Stories, novels. They all come from the writer's experience of reality worked upon, changed, filtered, distorted, clarified, transfigured by imagination. Ideas come from the world through the head. The interesting part of this process to me is the passage through the head, the action of the imagination on the raw material. But that's the part of the process that a great many people disapprove of. I wrote a piece years ago called Why Are Americans Afraid of Dragons? In it, I talked about how so many Americans distrust and despise not only the obviously imaginative kind of fiction we call fantasy, but all fiction, often rationalizing their fear and contempt with financial or religious arguments. Reading novels is a waste of valuable time. The only true book is the Bible, and so on. I said that many Americans have been taught to repress their imagination, to reject it as something childish or effeminate, unprofitable, and probably sinful. They have learned to fear the imagination, but they have never learned to discipline it at all. I wrote that in 1974. The millennium has come and gone, and we still fear dragons. If you fear something, you may try to diminish it. You infantilize it. Fantasy is for children. Kiddie lit. Can't take it seriously. But fantasy also has shown that it can make money. Gotta take that seriously. So in the first Harry Potter book, which combined two very familiar conventions, the British school story and the orphan child of great gifts, hit the big time, many reviewers praised it lavishly for its originality, by which they showed their absolute ignorance of both traditions the book follows, the small one of the school story and the great one, a tradition that descends from the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, the Thousand and One Nights and Beowulf and the Tale of Monkey and medieval romance and Renaissance epic, through Lewis Carroll and Kipling to Tolkien to Borges and Calvino and Rushdie and the rest of us. A tradition, a form of literature which really cannot be dismissed as entertainment, great fun for the kiddies, or, well, at least they're reading something. Critics and academics have been trying for 40 years to bury the greatest work of imaginative fiction in English. They ignore it. They condescend to it. They stand in large groups with their backs to it, because they're afraid of it. They're afraid of dragons. They have smogophobia. Oh, those awful orcs, they bleat, flocking after Edmund Wilson. They know if they acknowledge Tolkien, they'll have to admit that fantasy can be literature, and that therefore they'll have to redefine what literature is, and they're too damned lazy to do it. What the majority of our critics and teachers call literature is still modernist realism. All other forms of fiction, westerns, mysteries, science fiction, fantasy, romance, historical, regional, you name it, is dismissed as genre, sent to the ghetto. That the ghetto is about 12 times larger than the city and currently a great deal livelier, so what? Magic realism, though, that bothers them. They hear Gabriel Garcia Marquez gnawing quietly at the foundations of the ivory tower. They hear all these crazy Indians, American ones and Indian ones, dancing up in the attic of the New York Times book review. They think maybe if they just call it postmodernism, it will go away. To think that realistic fiction is by definition superior to imaginative fiction is to think imitation is superior to invention. In mean moments, I have wondered if this unstated but widely accepted, highly puritanical proposition is related to the recent popularity of the memoir and the personal essay. But that has been a genuine popularity, a real preference, not a matter of academic canonizing. People really do want to read memoir and personal essay, and writers want to write it. I felt rather out of step. I like history and biography, sure, but when family and personal memoir seems to be the dominant narrative form, well, I have searched my soul for prejudice and found it. I prefer invention to imitation. I love novels. I love made-up stuff. Our high valuation of story drawn directly from personal experience may be a logical extension of our high value for realism in fiction. If faithful imitation of actual experience is fiction's greatest virtue, then memoir is more virtuous than fiction can ever be. The memoir writer's imagination, subordinated to the hard facts, serves to connect the facts aesthetically and to draw from them a moral or intellectual lesson, but is understood to be forbidden to invent. Emotion will certainly be roused, but imagination may scarcely be called upon. Recognition, rather than discovery, is the reward. True recognition is a true reward. The personal essay is a noble and difficult discipline. I'm not knocking it. I admire it with considerable awe, but I'm not at home in it. I keep looking for dragons in this country and not finding any, or only finding them in disguise. Some of the most praised recent memoirs have been about growing up in poverty, hopeless poverty, cruel fathers, incompetent mothers, abused children, misery, fear, loneliness. But is this the property of nonfiction? Poverty, cruelty, incompetence, dysfunctional families, injustice, degradation, that is the very stuff of the fireside tale, the folk tale, stories of ghosts and vengeance beyond the grave, and of Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights and Huckleberry Finn and Cien Años de Soledad. The ground of our experience is dark, and all our inventions start in that darkness. From it, some of them leap forth in fire. The imagination can transfigure the dark matter of life, and in many personal essays and autobiographies, that's what I begin to miss. To crave transfiguration. To recognize our shared familiar misery is not enough. I want to recognize something I never saw before. I want the vision to leap out at me, terrible and blazing, the fire of the transfiguring imagination. I want the true dragons. Experience is where the ideas come from. But a story isn't a mirror of what happened. Fiction is experience translated by, transformed by, transfigured by the imagination. Truth includes but is not coextensive with fact. Truth in art is not imitation, but reincarnation. In a factual history or memoir, the raw material of experience to be valuable has to be selected, arranged, and shaped. In a novel, the process is even more radical. The raw materials are not only selected and shaped, but fused, composted, recombined, reworked, reconfigured, reborn, and at the same time allowed to find their own forms and shapes, which may be only indirectly related to rational thinking. The whole thing may end up looking like pure invention, a girl chained to a rock as a sacrifice to a monster, a mad captain and a white whale, a ring that confers absolute power. A dragon. But there's no such thing as pure invention. It all starts with experience. Invention is recombination. We can work only with what we have. There are monsters and leviathans and chimeras in the human mind. They are psychic facts. Dragons are one of the truths about us. We have no other way of expressing that particular truth about us. People who deny the existence of dragons are often eaten by dragons from within. Another way we have recently taken of showing our deep distrust of the imagination, our puritanical lust to control it and limit it, is in the way we tell stories electronically, on TV and in media such as electronic games and CD-ROMs. Reading is active. To read a story is to participate actively in the story. To read is to tell the story, tell it to yourself, reliving it, rewriting it with the author, word by word, sentence by sentence, chapter by chapter. If you want proof, just watch an 8-year-old reading a story she likes. She is concentratedly, tensely, fiercely alive. She is as intense as a hunting cat. She is a tiger eating. Reading is a most mysterious act. It absolutely has not been replaced and will not be replaced by any kind of viewing. Viewing is an entirely different undertaking with different rewards. A reader reading makes the book, brings it into meaning by translating arbitrary symbols, printed letters, into an inward, private reality. Reading is an act, a creative one. Viewing is relatively passive. A viewer watching a film does not make the film. To watch a film is to be taken into it, to participate in it, be made part of it, absorbed by it. Readers eat books. Film eats viewers. This can be wonderful. It's wonderful to be eaten by a good movie, to let your eyes and ears take your mind into a reality you could never otherwise know. However, passivity means vulnerability, and that's what a great deal of media storytelling exploits. Reading is an active transaction between the text and the reader. The text is under the control of the reader. She can skip, linger, interpret, misinterpret, return, ponder, go along with the story or refuse to go along with it, make judgments, revise her judgments. She has time and room to genuinely interact. A novel is an active, ongoing collaboration between the writer and the reader. Viewing is a different transaction. It isn't collaborative. The viewer consents to participate and hands over control to the filmmaker or programmer. Psychically, there is no time or room outside an audiovisual narrative for anything but the program. For the viewer, the screen or monitor temporarily becomes the universe. There's very little leeway and no way to control the constant stream of information and imagery unless one refuses to accept it, detaches oneself emotionally and intellectually, in which case it appears essentially meaningless, or one can turn the program off. Although there's a lot of talk about transactional viewing and interactive is a favorite word of programmers, the electronic media are a paradise of control for programmers and a paradise of passivity for viewers. There is nothing in so-called interactive programs except what the programmer put in them. The so-called choices lead only to sub-programs chosen by the programmer, no more a choice than a footnote is. Do you read it or don't you? The roles in role-playing games are fixed and conventional. There are no characters in games, only personae. That's why teenagers love them. Teenagers need personae, but they have to shed those personae eventually if they're going to become persons. Hypertext offers the storyteller a wonderful complexity, but so far hypertext fiction seems to be like Borges's garden of forking paths that lead only to other forking paths, fascinating, like fractals, and ultimately nightmarish. Interactivity in the sense of the viewer controlling the text is also nightmarish, when interpreted to mean that the viewer can rewrite the novel. If you don't like the end of Moby Dick, you can change it, you can make it happy. Ahab kills the whale. Ooh-wee. Readers can't kill the whale. They can only reread until they understand why Ahab collaborated with the whale to kill himself. Readers don't control the text. They genuinely interact with it. Viewers are either controlled by the program or try to control it. Different ballgames, different universes. When I was working on this talk, a 3D animated version of The Little Prince came out on CD-ROM. The blurb said it offers more than just the story of The Little Prince. You can, for example, catch an orbiting planet in The Little Prince's universe and learn all about the planet's secrets and its inhabitants. In the book, the prince visits several planets with extremely interesting inhabitants, and his own tiny planet has an immense secret. A rose, the rose he loves. Do these CD guys think Saint-Exupéry was stingy with his planets? Or are they convinced that stuffing irrelevant information into a work of art enriches it? Ah, but there is more. You can enter the fox training game, and after you've tamed the fox that the little prince meets, he will give you a gift. Do you remember the fox in The Little Prince? He insists that the little prince tame him. Why? The prince asks, and the fox says that if he is tamed, he will always love the wheat fields, because they're the color of the little prince's hair. The little prince asks how to tame him, and the fox says he has to do it by being very patient, sitting down at a little distance from me in the grass. I shall look at you out of the corner of my eye, and you will say nothing. Words are the source of misunderstanding. But you will sit a little closer to me every day. And it should be at the same time every day, so that the fox will know at what hour my heart is to be ready to greet you. One must observe the proper rites. And so the fox is tamed. And when the little prince is about to leave, "Ah," said the fox, "I shall cry." So the little prince laments, "Being tamed didn't do you any good." But the fox says, "It has done me good because of the color of the wheat fields." And when they part, the fox says, "I will make you a present of a secret. It is the time you wasted for your rose that makes your rose important. You become responsible forever for what you have tamed." So then the child viewing the CD-ROM tames the fox, that is, presses buttons until the food pellet drops into the food dish. No, sorry, that's rats. The child selects the right choices from the program till informed that the fox is tamed. Somehow this seems different from imagining doing what the book says, coming back every day at the same time and sitting silently while a fox looks at you from the corner of its eye. Something essential has been short-circuited, has been falsified. What do you think the fox's gift is in the CD-ROM? I don't know, but if it was a 24-carat gold ring with an emerald, it wouldn't top the fox's gift in the book, which is 9 words. You become responsible forever for what you have tamed. The gift the little prince gives its readers is itself. It offers them absolutely nothing but a charming story with a few charming pictures and the chance to face fear, grief, tenderness, and loss. Which is why that story, written in the middle of a war by a man about to die in that war, is honored by children, adults, and even literary critics. Maybe the CD-ROM isn't as ghastly as it sounds, but it's hard not to see it as an effort to exploit, to tame something that, like a real fox, must be left wild. The imagination of an artist. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry did crash land in the desert once in the 1930s and nearly died. That is a fact. He did not meet a little prince from another planet there. He met terror, thirst, despair, and salvation. He wrote a splendid factual account of that experience in Wind, Sand, and Stars, but later it got composted, transmuted, transfigured into a fantastic story of a little prince. Imagination working on experience. Invention springing like a flower, a rose, out of the desert sands of reality. Thinking about the sources of art, about where ideas come from, we often give experience too much credit. Earnest biographers often fail to realize that novelists make things up. They seek a direct source for everything in a writer's work, as if every character in a novel were based on a person the writer knew. Every plot gambit had to mirror a specific actual event. Ignoring the incredible recombinatory faculty of the imagination, this fundamentalist attitude short-circuits the long, obscure process by which experience becomes story. Aspiring writers keep telling me they'll start writing when they've gathered experience. Usually I keep my mouth shut, but sometimes I can't control myself and ask them, like Jane Austen? Like the Bronte sisters? Those women with their wild, mad lives, cram full of gut-wrenching adventure, working as stevedores in the Congo and shooting up drugs in Rio and hunting lions on Kilimanjaro and having sex in Soho and all that stuff that writers have to do. Well, that some writers have to do. Very young writers usually are handicapped by their relative poverty of experience. Even if their experiences are the stuff of which fiction can be made, and very often it's exactly the experiences of childhood and adolescence that feed the imagination all the rest of a writer's life, they don't have context, They don't yet have enough to compare it with. They haven't had time to learn that other people exist, people who have had similar experiences and different experiences, and that they themselves will have different experiences. A breadth of comparison, a fund of empathic knowledge, crucial to the novelist who, after all, is making up a whole world. So fiction writers are slow beginners. Few are worth much till they're 30 or so, not because they lack life experience, but because their imagination hasn't had time to context it and compost it, to work on what they've done and felt, and realize its value is where it's common to the human condition. Autobiographical first novels, self-centered and self-pitying, often suffer from poverty of imagination. But many fantasies, works of so-called imaginative fiction, suffer from the same thing, imaginative poverty. The writers haven't actually used their imagination, haven't made up anything. They've just moved archetypes around in a game of wish fulfillment, a saleable game. In fantasy, since the fictionality of the fiction, the inventions, the dragons, are all right out in front, it's easy to assume that the story has no relation at all to experience, that everything in a fantasy can be just the way the writer wants it. No rules, all cards wild. All the ideas in fantasy are just wishful thinking. Right? Well, no. Wrong. It may be that the further a story gets away from common experience and accepted reality, the less wishful thinking it can do, the more firmly its essential ideas must be grounded in common experience and accepted reality. Serious fantasy goes into regions of the psyche that may be very strange territory, dangerous ground, places where wise psychologists tread cautiously, and for that reason, serious fantasy is usually both conservative and realistic about human nature. Its mode is usually comic, not tragic. That is, it has a more or less happy ending. But just as the tragic hero brings his tragedy on himself, the happy outcome in fantasy is earned by the behavior of the protagonist. Serious fantasy invites the reader on a wild journey of invention, through wonders and marvels, through mortal risks and dangers, all the time hanging on to a common, everyday, realistic morality. Generosity, reliability, compassion, courage. In fantasy, these moral qualities are seldom questioned. They are accepted, and they are tested, often to the limit and beyond. The people who write the stuff on the book covers obsessively describe fantasy as a battle between good and evil. That phrase describes serious fantasy only in the sense of Solzhenitsyn's saying, the line between good and evil runs straight through every human heart. In serious fantasy, the real battle is moral and internal. We have met the enemy, as Pogo said, and he is us. To do good, heroes must know or learn that the axis of evil is within them. In commercial fantasy, the so-called battle of good and evil is a mere power struggle. Look at how they act. The so-called good wizards and the so-called bad ones are equally violent and irresponsible. This is about as far from Tolkien as you can get. But why should moral seriousness matter? Why do probability and consistency matter when it's all just made up? Well, moral seriousness is what makes a fantasy matter because it's what's real in the story. A made-up story is inevitably trivial if nothing real is at stake, if mere winning, coming out on top, replaces moral choice. Easy wish fulfillment has a great appeal to children who are genuinely powerless. But if it's all a story has to offer, in the end, it's not enough. In the same way, the purer the invention, the more important is its credibility, consistency, coherence. The rules of the invented realm must be followed to the letter. All magicians, including writers, are extremely careful about their spells. Every word must be the right word. A sloppy wizard is a dead wizard. Serious fantasists delight in invention, in the freedom to invent, but they know that careless invention kills the magic. Fantasy shamelessly flouts fact, but it is as deeply concerned with truth as the grimmest, grayest realism. A related point. The job of the imagination in making a story from experience may be not to gussy it up, but to tone it down. The world is unbelievably strange, and human behavior is frequently so weird that no kind of narrative except farce or satire can handle it. I am thinking of a true story I heard about a man who rationed his daughter's toilet paper. He had three daughters, and it infuriated him that they used so much toilet paper, so he tore all the toilet paper rolls into the little component squares and made three piles of six squares on the bathroom counter, and each daughter was to use one pile each day. You see what I mean? In a case like this, the function of the imagination is to judge whether anything so bizarre belongs in the story without turning it into farce or mere gross-out. The whole matter of leaving it to the imagination, that is, including elements of the story only by allusion and implication, is enormously important. Even journalists can't report the full event, but can only tell bits of it. Both the realist and the fantasist leave out a tremendous amount, suggesting through imagery or metaphors just enough that the reader can imagine the event. And the reader does just that. Story is a collaborative art. The writer's imagination works in league with the reader's imagination, calls on the reader to collaborate, to fill in, to flesh out, to bring their own experience to the work. Fiction is not a camera and not a mirror. It's much more like a Chinese painting. A few lines, a few blobs, a whole lot of blank space. From which we make the travelers, in the mist, climbing the mountain towards the inn under the pines. I have written fantastic stories closely based on actual experience, and realistic stories totally made up out of moonshine. Some of my science fiction is full of accurate and carefully researched fact, while my stories about ordinary people doing ordinary things on the Oregon coast in 1990 contain large wetlands and quicksands of pure invention. I will refer to some of my own works in hopes of showing how fictional ideas arise from a combination of experience and imagination that is indissoluble and unpredictable and doesn't follow orders. In my Earthsea books, particularly the first one, people sail around all the time on the sea in small boats. They do it quite convincingly, and many people understandably assume that I spent years sailing around on the sea in small boats. My entire experience with sailboats was in my junior semester in Berkeley High School, where they let us take sailing for gym credit. On a windy day in the Berkeley Marina, my friend Jean and I managed to overturn and sink a 9-foot catboat in 3 feet of water. We sang "Nearer My God to Thee" as she went down, and then waded a half mile back to the boathouse. The boatman was incredulous. "You sank it?" he said. "How?" That will remain one of the secrets of the writer. All right, so all that sailing around that Ged does in Earthsea does not reflect experience. Not my experience. Only my imagination, using that catboat and other people's experience, novels I'd read, and some research. I do know why Look Far is clinker-built, and asking friends questions and some trips on ocean liners, but basically it's a fake. So is all the snow and ice in The Left Hand of Darkness. I never even saw snow till I was 17, and I certainly never pulled a sledge across a glacier. Except with Scott and Shackleton and those guys. In books. Where do you get your ideas from? From books, of course. From other people's books. What are books for? If I didn't read, how could I write? We writers all stand on each other's shoulders. We all use each other's ideas and skills and plots and secrets. Literature is a communal enterprise. That anxiety of influence stuff is just testosterone talking. Understand me, I don't mean plagiarism. I'm not talking about imitation or copying or theft. If I thought I had really deliberately used any other writer's writing, I certainly wouldn't stand here congratulating myself. I'd go hide my head in a paper bag, along with several eminent historians. What I mean is that stuff from other people's books gets into us just as our own experience does, and, like actual experience, gets composted and transmuted and transformed by the imagination and comes forth entirely changed, our own, growing out of our own mind's earth. So, I acknowledge with delight my endless debt to every storyteller I have ever read, factual or fictional, my colleagues, my collaborators. I praise them and honor them, the endless givers of gifts. In my science fiction novel set on a planet populated by people whose gender arrangements are highly imaginative, the part about two people hauling a sledge across a glacier is as factually accurate as I could make it, down to the details of their gear and harness, how much weight they haul, how far they can get in a day, what different snow surfaces are like, and so on. None of this is from my direct experience. All of it is from the books I've read about the Antarctic ever since I was in my 20s. It is factual material woven into a pure fantasy. As a matter of fact, so is all the stuff about their gender arrangements. But that's a little too complicated to go into here. Once I wanted to write a story from the point of view of a tree. The idea of the story came with the sight of an oak alongside the road to McMinnville. I was thinking as we drove by that when that oak was young, Highway 18 was a quiet country road. I wondered what the oak thought about the highway, the cars. Well, so where do I get the experience of being a tree on which my imagination is to work? Books don't help much here. Unlike Shackleton and Scott, oaks don't keep diaries. Personal observation is my only experiential material. I have seen a lot of oaks, been around oaks, been in some oaks externally, climbing around. Now I want to be in one internally, inside. What does it feel like to be an oak? Large, for one thing. Lively, but quiet. And not very flexible, except at the tips, out there in the sunlight. And deep, very deep, roots going down in the dark. To live rooted, to be 200 years in one place, unmoving, yet traveling immensely through the seasons, the years, through time. Well, you know how it's done. You did it as a kid. You still do it. If you don't do it, your dreams do it for you. In dreams begins responsibility, said a poet. In dreams, in imagination, we begin to be one another. I am thou. The barriers go down. Big stories, novels, don't come from just one stimulus, but a whole clumping and concatenation of ideas and images, visions and mental perceptions, all slowly drawing in around some center, which is usually obscure to me until long after the book's done, and I finally say, oh, that's what that book's about. To me, two things are essential during the drawing together, the clumping process, before I know much of anything about the story. I have to see the place, the landscape, and I have to know the principal people by name, and it has to be the right name. If it's the wrong name, the character won't come to me. I won't know who they are. I won't be able to be them. They won't talk. They won't do anything. Please don't ask me how I arrive at the name and how I know when it's the right name. I have no idea. When I hear it, I know it. And I know where the person is. And then the story can begin. Here is an example. My recent book, The Telling. Unlike most of my stories, it started with something you really could call an idea, a fact I had learned. I had been interested most of my life in the Chinese philosophy called Taoism. At the same time that I finally also learned a little about the religion called Taoism, an ancient popular religion of vast complexity, a major element of Chinese culture for two millennia, I learned that it had been suppressed, almost entirely wiped out, by Mao Zedong. In one generation, one psychopathic tyrant destroyed a tradition 2,000 years old, in my lifetime, and I knew nothing about it. The enormity of the event and the enormity of my ignorance left me stunned. I had to think about it. Since the way I think is fiction, eventually I had to write a story about it. But how could I write a novel about China? My poverty of experience would be fatal. A novel set on an imagined world, then, about the extinction of a religion as a deliberate political act, counterpointed by the suppression of political freedom by a theocracy? All right, there's my theme, my idea, if you will. I'm impatient to get started, impassioned by the theme, so I look for the people who will tell me the story, the people who are going to live this story, and I find this uppity kid, this smart girl who goes from Earth to that world. I don't remember what her name was. She had 5 different names, and none of them was the true name. I started the book 5 times. It got nowhere. I had to stop. I had to sit patiently and say nothing at the same time every day while the fox looked at me from the corner of its eye and slowly let me get a little bit closer. And finally, the woman whose story it was spoke to me. "I'm Sutty," she said. "Follow me." So I followed her, and she led me up into the high mountains, and she gave me the book. I had a good idea, but I did not have a story. Critics talk as if stories were all idea, but intellect does not make story any more than ideology makes art. The story had to make itself, find its center, find its voice. Sutty's voice. Then, because I was waiting for it, it could give itself to me. Or put it this way, I had a lot of stuff in my head, good stuff, clear ideas, but I couldn't pull it together, I couldn't dance with it, because I hadn't waited to catch the beat. I didn't have the rhythm. This book takes its title from a letter from Virginia Woolf to her friend Vida Sackville West. Vida had been pontificating about finding the right word, Flaubert's mot juste, and agonizing very Frenchly about style, and Virginia wrote back very Englishly, "As for the mot juste, you are quite wrong. Style is a very simple matter. It is all rhythm. Once you get that, you can't use the wrong words. But on the other hand, here am I sitting after half the morning, crammed with ideas and visions and so on, and can't dislodge them for lack of the right rhythm. Now, this is very profound, what rhythm is, and goes far deeper than words. A sight, an emotion, creates this wave in the mind long before it makes words to fit it, and in writing, such is my present belief, one has to recapture this and set this working, which has nothing apparently to do with words, and then, as it breaks and tumbles in the mind, it makes words to fit it. But no doubt I shall think differently next year." Wolf wrote that 80 years ago, and if she did think differently next year, she didn't tell anybody. She says it lightly, but she means it. This is very profound. I have not found anything more profound or more useful about the source of story, where the ideas come from. Beneath memory and experience, beneath imagination and invention, beneath words, as she says, there are rhythms to which memory and imagination and words all move, and the writer's job is to go down deep enough to begin to feel that rhythm, to find it, move to it, be moved by it, and let it move memory and imagination to find words. She's full of ideas, but she can't dislodge them, she says, because she can't find their rhythm, can't find the beat that will unlock them, set them moving forward into a story, get them telling themselves. A wave in the mind, she calls it, and says that a sight or an emotion may create it, like a stone dropped into still water, and the circles go out from the center in silence, in perfect rhythm, and the mind follows those circles outward and outward till they turn to words. But her image is greater. Her wave is a sea wave, traveling smooth and silent 1,000 miles from the ocean till it strikes the shore and crashes, breaks, and flies up in a foam of words. But the wave, the rhythmic impulse, is before words, has nothing to do with words. So the writer's job is to recognize the wave, the silent swell, way out at sea, way out in the ocean of the mind, and follow it to shore, where it can turn or be turned into words, unload its story, throw out its imagery, pour out its secrets, and ebb back into the ocean of story. What is it that prevents the ideas and visions from finding their necessary underlying rhythm? Why couldn't Wolf dislodge them that morning? It could be a thousand things, distractions, worries, but very often I think what keeps a writer from finding the words is that she grasps at them too soon, hurries, grabs. She doesn't wait for the wave to come in and break. She wants to write because she's a writer. She wants to say this and tell people that and show people something else. Things she knows, her ideas, her opinions, her beliefs, important ideas. But she doesn't wait for the wave to come and carry her beyond all the ideas and opinions to where you cannot use the wrong word. None of us is Virginia Woolf, but I hope every writer has had at least a moment when they rode the wave and all the words were right. As readers, we have all ridden that wave and known that joy. Prose and poetry, all art, music, dance, rise from and move with the profound rhythms of our body, our being, and the body and being of the world. Physicists read the universe as a great range of vibrations, of rhythms. Art follows and expresses those rhythms. Once we get the beat, the right beat, our ideas and our words dance to it, the round dance that everybody can join. And then I am thou, and the barriers are down. For a little while.